Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery on Round Rock, where we talk about games, comics, and other stuff on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And let's go to the show for this week. It's the Roguecast for the week of Wednesday, June 10th, and we're starting off, as always, with our news. This is the week when we are doing our Reading with Rogues already, so we can't talk about Reading with Rogues yet, but we'll have one in July. Ladies' Night is Wednesday, June 10th, over at Star Coffee. No, Kirby Lane. Kirby Lane this
is
one.
Is Kirby Lane?
Yes. Okay, Kirby Lane.
The new Round Rock Kirby Lane, which I finally got a chance to go to, and it's nice.
Yeah.
It's got a little counter, like a diner counter.
Yeah, they sort of have a long hallway and a larger room, which I mostly get seated in the hallway.
And I had the Elvis pancakes, which had peanut butter and bacon and banana.
They looked good, even though they forgot to bring you the peanut buttery part.
Yes, they did, and I thought for a second they'd screwed over my pancakes, but they
didn't. You know, they had one or two screw-ups in the first time or two I went, and they comped me on, like, some stuff.
Oh, wow.
I don't think they comped you on your pancakes.
That's all right. They didn't screw it up. It was just a minor
minor hiccup. That's a screw up. No, but generally, I appreciate when they're, like, getting off their feet. I understand there are going to be a few mistakes, but at least they tried to make up for it.
Right. And then on Monday, June 15th, we'll have our Gaming with Rogues, which is going to be King of Tokyo, which I'm kind of sad to miss, but I'll be at Disney World.
Oh.
So sad for me.
Yeah.
And our usual guy, Chris Jones, who runs it, will also be out of town. So where our friend Rachel from Georgetown Library is going to run that for us.
Who is a very awesome person.
She is. And that's going to be at BJ's Brewhouse. Free RPG Day is Saturday, June 20th. That is fast approaching. Dave, do you have an announcement regarding that, or is it still in the works?
What am I talking about?
Your announcement for Free RPG Day.
You know, I'm trying to gather the people for it, and so I'd say I don't know for sure it's going to come off.
So there may be a cool announcement, or if there isn't, it didn't come together.
Or it'll be a sad, sad day.
Wah, wah. And then, of course, Saturday, June 27th is our all-ages event. All Ages Awesomeness 5. Very much looking forward to that. It is rapidly approaching. And then once that's over, I can rest and not stress for a while.
Sure,
you can just go into your cave and hibernate.
Yes.
Sure, you'll find something.
We'll wake you for winter.
I'll find something, but the All Ages Awesomeness and Free Comic Book Day and inventory are the things I stress the most about all year.
When you come back, you can start playing Batman. Doesn't that come out? The Arkham Knight?
Oh, yeah. Totally. Yep.
I mean, that's what I'm going to do.
You can stress about getting through all the levels and keeping up with Nick.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to keep up with Nick.
It's not like I'm going to, you know, close myself off and play it nonstop for 24 hours.
That sounds like exactly what you're going to do.
Shut up.
We do have some news this week. So let's start with the interesting comics news, which is the teasers. Some people might consider this – we're close news with that because some people might consider that a spoiler and then I can jump ahead. So instead, we're going to talk about the Aquaman director.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah. Mr. James Wan.
Yes, who directed
– and this is definitive, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
He is probably best known as director of, like, Insidious and The Conjuring, as best known as a horror director.
Okay.
But his biggest seller...
Yeah, Fast and the Furious 6?
7.
7.
Was it?
Fast 7.
7.
Fast, yeah.
Well, that is that's quite a diverse profile.
Yeah. And that thing, didn't that, like, make more money than any of them?
Oh, of course.
I think, because each one essentially does that at this point.
Yeah.
So that guy, it's sort of like... He has, like, now huge movies to his name as well as his smaller.
I'm sure he, with the success of Fast 7, they were like, what would you like to do? And he chose Aquaman.
Yeah.
I'm surprised we're getting a standalone Aquaman movie, to be honest.
So this is Aquaman with, have we heard?
Jason Momoa.
Jason Momoa, yep. That's right.
Yeah. He would be a savage sort of Aquaman going by the pictures.
Yeah.
He may be a very civil Aquaman, but he looks like Conan.
It's an interesting take. We don't know a whole lot about it, but I assume the DC will find a way to screw it up. But so far, so good.
Here's the thing: I do like James Wan. I've liked his horror movies. There's occasional nitpicks I have with him, but overall, he's like very reliable when it comes to that. And I look forward to his movies. And he did a good job with the Fast 7 stuff. Mm-hmm. So,
I'm sure that Zack Snyder will have some good. Zack Snyder and David Goyer will have some good input for him, and they'll probably correct those minor nitpicks.
Why you crush our hopes and dreams? Sorry, Andy. Actually, honestly, although I've enjoyed many iterations of Aquaman over the years, Savage Aquaman isn't quite what I necessarily would want to see. It so clearly pushes the movie into that darker direction, which fits everything else they're doing.
Yeah.
But would not be what I would want.
But
I don't necessarily want like Super Friends Aquaman, but perhaps
or Brave and the Bold Aquaman.
Or Brave and the Bold Aquaman.
That was the best version.
It is the best version.
Yeah, that would be a hoot though if they did.
Oh, it'd be great, but they're not gonna do that.
Total bonkers Aquaman in the middle of all their grim and gritty. Do you bleed Kryptonian? I don't think he does.
Patrick Warburton playing live action Brave and the Bold Aquaman. Yeah, I could totally see that.
I'd be down for it. His sheer exuberance could undo all the darkness of the other movies.
Yep. But instead, we're going to get grim and gritty.
He is going to be like you surface dwellers.
Yeah. Yep.
With your pollution and your six-pack yolks strangling my pelicans.
And dolphins.
Dave, I think you got your trailer. Your teaser all set here, that's good. Speaking of trailers, we did watch a couple this week. One is the trailer for The Martian, a book we've all read and enjoyed.
Yep.
And this has Matt Damon, who seems a good person to play the main lead.
I think so. He's got the star power and sort of still at a bit of an everyman quality.
And this is another big all-star cast, like Jessica Chastain's in it, Jeff Daniels.
Yeah,
I mean, forget who all was in it.
I heard Jeff Daniels doing the narration, and I'm like, am I watching Newsroom?
Yes. When you say the Mars is the best planet in the solar system,
I don't know what the heck you're talking about. Olympus Mons?
So what did you guys think of the trailer?
I thought it was pretty good, although I wasn't, like, wowed by it.
Nick? Yeah, solid. I think nothing will sort of rival the entertainment of the book.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was. It's very actiony. It looks like they've captured the vibe of the book, you know.
Yeah. I saw stuff both on... Well, I was a little surprised that I don't want to say that they gave away a lot, but they did give away some things that occur sort of midway through the book and some of the Earthbound stuff.
Although, if you haven't read the book, I don't think you're going to know it's a spoiler.
Correct. I think that's true, too. I did see, like, I recognized when they did a shot of a bunch of different characters in the book, I was like, oh, that's that. And that's who that is. And that's the guy from the Astronauts.
My biggest issue with it, and I thought it was a good trailer as well. Yeah. They did a good job of sort of pumping it up as an action-y kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is that the book had that sort of, like Nick said, it has that, it's fun. It's also very science-y. Mm-hmm. And I think that I don't think that's going to translate as well to the medium. Well, I think this is going to be a very different story.
Well, and also sort of the inner monologues that he has with himself. I mean, it was via a journal to NASA. I mean, you could sort of
find a way to pare it down.
They'll probably voice over it. Probably a fair amount of voice over him talking to the camera, that kind of thing. Sort of Castaway.
Yeah.
Castaway style. I think...
Obviously, you're not going to get into science at the level that the book did.
No.
Even though that was still, in a way, cursory-ish science.
Sure,
like,
sure.
There, he did. He was like, I did a bunch of number crunching. Sometimes he'll say stuff like that, and he won't show you his formulas.
Speed along a few things.
So, but I think they will be able to suggest, like, I mean, like, you know, one of the problems he runs into is, can he possibly grow any sort of crops or anything on there? And I'm like, the explanation, although there's a lot of science involved in the book, is simple enough, and there will be some fun reveals about that.
Yeah.
The one thing that the trailer showed that I was a little worried about, and maybe I just saw it wrong. Of course, the sex scene.
With the Martian?
Yeah, with the Martian.
I am from Mars, and I have come to have sex with you, last astronaut from Earth. Well, that was a weird addition.
Later in the trailer where he's, like, looking at a computer screen, and obviously, like, a woman and a young child.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Did they add a wife and daughter
to
some sort of connection for him?
Yeah.
And that was sort of a thing that I liked
so
much
about him and not maybe one of the other astronauts?
No, it was him.
It was him?
Hmm. And I was like, I kind of liked the notion that it was just him. I mean, he didn't have any...
Yeah.
That does
sound very Hollywood, though. Well, no one's going to care if you don't have a wife and daughter back home.
Right. Yeah, and I'm like,
I hope they don't do that.
I am very hopeful that they don't do it.
You know what else? I'm looking forward to it. I can't remember who's directing it. It's somebody good. Oh, it's Ridley Scott, who's hit and miss. So you never know.
Hit and miss, but with something like this, it's fairly straightforward. I think he has a good chance of getting it right.
You know, he's going to try to bring this into his Blade Runner. No, not Blade
Prometheus
Runner.
Prometheus Universe. I've discovered something on the surface of Mars.
This weird ship. This giant.
It's funny. Explain it.
What's funny is that the Martian is a book, is something that works really well as a book, and I think if they were going to translate it, I almost would have rather seen a graphic novel.
That's
like that, I think would have translated well because you can mix that inner monologue.
Is it Andy Weir?
Andy Weir? I don't think so. I think he's still working on. I mean, I'm sure he's done some stuff. It's a pretty short story.
Should have been an audio play. Actually, I could almost see it.
Well, that'd be a lot of narration.
How about a stage play?
Sure. Actually, it could work as a stage play. That's the thing.
That's true.
You would need voiceover for it. But
yep.
or he would just talk to the audience.
Yep.
But here's the thing. I think I maybe like the Martian the least among us. I had some issues with it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe some of my issues were just kind of like, I didn't feel like some of the humor in the book didn't really hit me. Yep. And
not enough tripods.
I mean, he is a wise ass. I mean,
right. Yeah. But I felt like it didn't have much more than that.
Yeah.
And that maybe that, what was it? That there was a little bit of science-y repetition to it. And I feel like the movie may actually help on that basis. Yeah. So I might actually prefer the movie to the book. I liked the book, but I didn't love it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it'll rival my favorite space exploration film. This is Apollo 13.
I doubt it.
Dave's is Contact?
Probably so. Yeah, I mean, you know, those are actually pretty different kind of things. I mean, Apollo 13 for sort of more real science, it's pretty amazing.
Well, I mean, it's just sort of that cast I mean, Ron Howard
it's probably
really
the best movie Ron Howard will ever make, almost certainly. But, yeah, Contact is my favorite, even though I recognize it takes all sorts of crazy
liberties. Some people might say The Right Stuff is their favorite. You don't know?
You know, I saw that
I don't
when
think
I, was
I have a favorite.
When I was a kid...
Star Wars is my favorite.
Space. You want to punch space in the nose?
I did go to see Space Camp when I was a teenager, and I remember thinking that was okay.
I mean, Matt Damon already played the lone survivor on a planet in Interstellar.
That's true. That was definitely not my favorite Space
Camp.
No,
it's nobody's favorite.
Nope. No. Well, it might be Christopher Nolan's.
I was taken to see The Right Stuff. When did that come out? 85?
I think it was 84, yeah.
Yeah, I was like probably about 11 at the time then, and I was a little too young to care about it. It was just kind of boring to me.
Yeah.
I have not seen it really all the way through since. I've seen bits and pieces, and I was like, oh, this looks much better than 11-year-old Dave thought it was.
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid that my neighbors had a VCR. This was a big deal because it was pretty new.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a few movies. And I remember as a kid, I was like, why do you have these movies? Because, like, this was the time when Indiana Jones had come out. Like, and they had Patton.
Oh,
and I'm
okay,
like,
yeah.
And I'm like, to like an 11 or 12-year-old kid, Patton is the most boring idea ever.
Right.
So.
Right. Couldn't they at least have gotten the Dirty Dozen or something?
Yeah. Why not something like that? Yeah. So.
All right. What else? What else
so
here?
There was also a trailer, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, right.
Which is Ian McKellen playing a retired Sherlock Holmes.
Right. Have you guys seen this trailer?
Yes.
Yet?
I watched the trailer.
So, I saw this at the Arbor, the trailer at the Arbor this weekend, and it does seem to, you were saying earlier, Randy, have a slight art house vibe.
Yeah.
And I think it is. It's not like action-adventure. In fact, his aging Sherlock Holmes has made it clear that the books were embellishments and got things wrong.
Yeah.
But sort of done with that charm that Ian McKellen brings.
Yeah, there is a murder mystery involved.
And it looks like a young boy who he kind of bonds with, who's maybe going to sort of help him.
Is it a young boy or a young girl?
I thought
I guess you're right, it's a young boy.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a young boy.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You only watched
You're right, it's a young boy.
But, and I can't remember, like, a great deal beyond that other than, I'm betting it's going to deal with his mortality, sort of, his agedness. I know at one point the kid is asking him to, like, kind of do the parlor trick sort of Sherlock Holmes, like, when's the part when you figure out, where he works based on the grid under his fingernails, and he's kind of, like, laughing at that. And it sort of looked like it had both slightly dry British humor as well as, like, a lot of charm and sort of humanity to it.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. I don't know that I'm 100% on board. I like my Sherlock Holmes like I like my Iron Man with Robert Downey Jr. in it. But it looks interesting.
I'm very excited to see it. I thought it looked like a really good movie, not too predictable as far as, like, I couldn't tell from the trailer exactly what it was going to be fully about or where it was going to go. But I highly recommend people check out the trailer.
I hope it's going to be surprisingly like Bad Boys 2. Ian McKellen wielding two guns. Shit just got real. I think maybe that.
They'll have to CG him, I think. I don't know if Ian McKellen's up for that.
He can
but
do
sure.
it. He's up for it. Okay. He's game.
Yeah.
Patrick Stewart will play the other guy. Bad Boys 3, Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart. Tell me you wouldn't watch that.
I'd not see it.
Even if it was directed by Michael Bay?
Even if it was directed by Michael Bay.
No. You killed it, Nick. Thanks a lot.
All right. So moving on to the comics. We're going to get to the spoiler territory in a second. But first, there was a piece written by John Ostrander, who you might not know does a sort of semi-regular column over at a site called Comic Mix.
It's a good column.
It is a good column. It's usually pretty brief, but it's interesting. Ostrander's a guy who really knows writing and thinks about writing.
And by the way, if you don't know him, he's sort of a working writer and is not like sort of a superstar, but he's – amongst his fans, we're very dedicated.
Yep, I am definitely an Ostrander fan.
So am I, and I'm going to guess most people who have read a Star Wars comic from the past 10 years has read something by John.
Yeah,
Ostrander.
He did. He introduced Kate Skywalker, the Star Wars legacy stuff, but also Quinlan Voss was his creation. Aayla Secura was his creation.
Yep. Stuff that people have made it into other expanded universe stuff.
So a lot of the Clone Wars stuff he wrote. He also wrote our favorite book, the Star Wars Agent of the Empire. Yep. He wrote 2 volumes of that.
Have we actually said what he's most famous for?
Though? Most famous though is Suicide Squad.
Right.
Yeah. DC's Suicide Squad, which of course is becoming a very big thing. There's a movie in the works. It's got a new title that's been going for a while.
It's been in the animation. It's been in Arrow.
Yep.
It's been in the Batman video games.
Yep.
And, Randy, I guess both of us, especially me, because I was there before you.
Oh, I see how it is.
You came in late on it. We're cool enough, though, to say we were there back when, before it was cool.
You were writing from first issue, weren't you?
Yes. I was there on board when they debuted in Legends.
See, and
that's when I was getting on board DC.
I picked up around issue, like, 25 or 30. And it ran about 60 issues. And Nick, of course, read it all later.
You got all the rest.
Oh, I did. I've read it all, and I own it all.
I have not read all of it.
But just recently inherited, I believe,
the full
collection.
A customer/friend of ours basically gave me the entire run.
Nice.
That's pretty amazing.
This is maybe, if my house was on fire and I had to save one run of comics, this is probably what I'd come out with.
Same here, actually. I was more dedicated to that book than I have really any book ever since. And it was also sort of my first heartbreak in comics.
Yeah.
Now, it got what now I would recognize as a good solid
60
run.
Issues is a good one. That's 5 years.
Yep. But when it ended, I didn't know it was coming. And I like read that last page and I was like, what?
I knew it was coming, but I was still sad.
Actually, by the way, that's still one of my all-time favorite farewells.
It's a great ending.
Yeah.
It's a great ending.
And I don't mean just like the issue itself, but also their...
The text piece.
You know, the co-writer for a portion of the book was his wife, Kim Yale, who passed away.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe she was there through the end of the book.
She was.
And they both reminisced about their favorite moments in that and things that they had struggled with. And I love their afterword to it.
So we bring this up because John Ostrander's latest column is called Suicide Squad, Story Behind the Story. And it's a quick... just sort of run down of the history of it. And he talks about working with Robert Greenberger, who was his first editor, that, you know, he was mostly working at First Comics. And I thought it was funny. He said he wanted to work.
First was like kind of like the equivalent of maybe a smaller Dark Horse or something like that. It was like lesser known, but known indie imprint.
Well, he said, you know, Bob asked him about working for DC because Bob Greenberger was working for DC. And he said, I love the title Child of the Unknown, which was lying fallow at the time. He says, consider then and now this is one of the great titles in comics. All by itself, it conjures up possibilities. And he's right. That's a great title.
I would, by the way, love for John Ostrander to go to DC and do a new Challengers of the Unknown
Indeed.
Book.
Yeah. But somebody already grabbed it for development, so that was off the table.
Do you know who that was, by the way?
I'm going to guess, was that Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale?
Yeah, that was like their first work together, and it was a weird book.
It was a weird book.
I wish it had gone to Ostrander, but I don't regret what we got.
Right. So instead, he got Suicide Squad that Bob Greenberger suggested. And it appeared in 5 issues of Showcase a million years ago. Nothing's being done with it. So he said his first reaction was, what a stupid name. Who in their right minds would belong to a group called itself Suicide Squad? And just as I was dismissing the whole thing, an answer struck me. The only ones who would join would be those who had no other choice. Who doesn't have any other choice? Folks in prison. Supervillains who've been caught. How do they get out of prison so fast? The Squad. And I thought that was an interesting thing that he didn't really deal with in the books, but it was actually an in-story explanation for how there's this revolving door at supervillain prisons.
Right.
They sort of why do they keep getting out to bedevil the heroes? Because they're making a deal with the government to get out.
Right.
And I think that was interesting. They never explored that, really.
Not really, yeah.
But I liked that idea that was sort of one of the things that was in his head.
Mm-hmm.
But then, he says, I thought about Dirty Dozen, The Mission Impossible, and the Secret Society of Supervillains, all of which are very obvious influences
on
it.
Sure.
And he... basically said, you know, he wanted to bring in characters like B and C listers so he could be free to kill them. Bob suggested that we have some superheroes in it as well, and he said he was against it, but Bob was insistent. It turned out he was right.
Yeah, so that's why we've got, like, in the group, there were the stabilizing influences of, like, Bronze Tiger,
Rick Flag
from who had a link to the original.
And these are all sort of anti-hero heroes. They're all a bit driven.
Right. Everybody, he made sure everybody in the group was damaged.
And then he created Amanda Waller, one of the great characters of all time.
Yep.
As he describes her, tough as nails, heavy set, middle aged, bad attitude, African American woman.
Yep.
And she's great, and I love, and we love Fat Waller. We do not like Skinny Waller.
Yes. The crazy thing is, like, this is how cool a character she is. If I were to, like, get a sketch from, say, one of the original artists, you know, of course there's memorable characters like Captain Boomerang and Rick Flag, but there is nobody more emblematic of the squad than Amanda Waller herself.
Yep.
And it would be as crazy as it would be, I would probably want an Amanda Waller sketch.
See, I have two sketches. I have a Captain Boomerang and I have a Deadshot, but I do not have a Waller, and that should be next on my list.
I don't know if the original artist Luke McDonald is still around.
He's still around, but I don't know if he's Jeff Isherwood I follow on Facebook.
Yeah.
And he was the guy who came on issue 33.
Yeah.
But Luke McDonald was the initial guy, mm-hmm. and Carl Kiesel was the inker and also sort of story kibitzer, basically.
By the way, the name Suicide Squad, I do seem to remember when I was reading this comic, I was probably around 13 or maybe 14. I do sort of remember, because it was my favorite, having to sort of explain it to my parents. Like, it's not like a book about suicide. It's like they go on dangerous missions.
So then he says, he explains, Deadshot had a cool name, a really stupid costume when he first appeared, that Marshall Rogers later revamped and made really cool.
Yeah, he only had the wrist guns.
And only a few background facts. He was technically a Batman villain, but the Bat Office said they didn't want him, so he's free to give him a backstory and a bit more character.
And now Deadshot's become a thing.
And Deadshot, and he gave him a great backstory. Really interesting that he explores throughout.
It's clear he became one of the big focuses of the book.
Deadshot has been on every iteration of Suicide Squad.
He's essentially became the most iconic character, even trumping Rick Flagg, who was the ostensible leader.
And then Captain Boomerang, a Flash character. The Flash had just been revamped as a result of Crisis. And at that point, the Flash office no longer using the Rogues, which is insane, by the way.
Yeah. Right.
No matter what you're doing, the Flash, you don't give up the Rogues.
Right.
But
it was a somewhat aimless time for Flash, but also, I guess it was, this would be just post-Crisis.
Yeah.
Actually, that was Mike Barron, and then later, who
was
it?
Going up against,
and then William Lester Lopes. Yeah.
But he was going up against, like, Vandal Savage.
There were original ones like Kilgore and Chunk and stuff like that, and it was weird, but in retrospect, I am kind of glad that he introduced some weird new characters. Who were the Soviet speedsters?
I don't remember what they're called, but Red the Soviet.
Something, yeah.
They were a trinity of speedsters, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was all good stuff. I did
enjoy seeing new villains and stuff.
Me too, but I'm just, given how popular the Rogues are, it's hard to imagine a time when the Rogues would not have been.
Maybe because prior to that, when they had done that long trial of Flash, pre-Crisis that people had gotten tired of.
Yeah.
That the Rogues did not have the cachet they do now.
Well, he says his first reaction was, "What a stupid character." He says, "I really need to learn not to do that." He decided to make the character like the character Flashman in the series of historical novels by George MacDonald Fraser. Boomerang was an asshole, but he knew what he was and he liked it.
Yep.
And he became a favorite as well.
Yeah, he was a fantastic, unrepentant kind of bastard character.
So then Greenberger got him an issue of Secret Origins so they could sort of explore the previous.
Right.
And then Mike Gold, his editor at First Comics, stepped in and got Ostrander to write Legends with artist John Byrne.
Right.
And they introduced Squad in there.
Because the Legends was like what was maybe only like the second kind of crossover they had done at DC after Crisis on Infinite Earths. And the notion that this basically fledgling writer would get a shot at it, and was able to introduce the book he would later be running in there. I remember reading at some point from the ever cranky John Byrne, something somewhat dismissive of Ostrander's writing talent at the time. But I've always kind of liked Legends. I mean, it's not a great crossover, but, from that time when they were still feeling it out, it's got a lot of good stuff in it. Byrne's art on it is great, I gotta say. I really liked his version of Guy Gardner and all of that other stuff that I learned from the time.
And Ostrander at his worst is better than John Byrne at his best.
I wouldn't necessarily say that.
I know, but I will.
But I was the guy who was called an asshole by him.
I know. And I take it more personally than you do.
Yeah. But I have to stand by his work like Man of Steel and stuff like that.
Yep.
But anyway, I think that was whatever break got John Ostrander that job, obviously it worked out.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a great little piece. Go ahead and read that. I'll put a link in our show notes. And Nick, where are you on Suicide Squad reread right now?
I'm starting up issue. I mean, I just started last night, so I'm on issue 7.
Okay.
So they just
That's what would basically have been in the first collection when they've occasionally.
They're still in Russia.
Oh, and the Russia story is great because they use the Penguin.
They use the Penguin. Their mission has hit the fan. Enchantress has gone insane.
Yep.
Deadshot shot her in the head.
Yep.
It's all just so much. They're about to go up against basically the Soviet super soldiers.
Yeah.
I can't remember the lady they're trying to rescue.
She's a novelist, right?
She's a novelist.
She doesn't want to be rescued.
And she doesn't want to be rescued.
And no one's wanted to. no one knew that.
You know, that's a comic
she
thing.
She wanted to be a martyr, basically.
Yeah,
right?
G.I. Joe did the same thing. Remember Dr. Burke in the first issue of G.I. Joe? Yeah. She didn't want to be rescued.
I wonder if there's any possibility that this is sort of loosely based on some story that I don't know about, some fat historical thing.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Early
80s. Ostringer from you know, the first issue just does an amazing amount of character work.
Well, the first issue has that great the jihad attacks an airport, and
that is brutal.
It's a brutal action sequence. Yeah,
the people.
Yep.
Am I correct though? That was just like a trial.
It's a training. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a hell of a way to start the issue.
Yeah,
but it's interesting because then I think in the second issue you see the squad go up against this, you know, ruthless team, and you sort of see how they handle it. I mean,
yeah.
Boomerang, you know, pulls out justice.
Yeah,
I think the speedster that they have on
he's like
jihad,
not as fast as the Flash.
Well, yeah, he's like, you're not in his class.
Well, he was like through the boomerang. The guy obviously maneuvered around the boomerang. He was like, but it comes back and it smacked.
Yeah,
and then he just.
Kicks him off a cliff.
Yep.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it's funny because, you know, if you know the behind-the-scenes thing that you were just reading, he apparently had thought it kind of had a little contempt at first.
Yeah.
And then, but he's like, well, I guess I'm going to make him a little bit effective, you know, in his
Yeah, but
in
then you see, and not a few panels later, Boomerang lets one of his Suicide Squad's compatriots die.
Because he's pissed at her.
Right. She gets shot.
She made fun of him.
Mind boggler, right?
Yeah, she confronted him and made him look bad.
Right.
And he just walks up to the rest of the squad and is like, yep, she got killed.
Yep.
Yeah. So these eight issues, you're at seven.
Yeah.
Along with Secret Origins issue, are all going to be collected in the Suicide Squad trade in a couple of months. And we will definitely be pointing that to people.
I'm going to go ahead and recommend it in advance.
Yep, me too.
I mean,
it's so good.
It's an amazing story. And also, I will say, a lot of people should know, I mean, Ostringer is the person who created Oracle.
That's correct.
That's right. In Suicide Squad.
She had gotten her injury in The Killing Joke.
Yep.
Was essentially lying fallow at that point.
Yep.
And I've never known much of the backstory beyond that, other than I think he felt like he did not like that. I believe he did not like
the. Well, either him or Kim Yale, the two of them were the ones who created her.
And honestly, I do believe, for me at least, that is the most enduring iteration of Batgirl. And it's the one that so many people know through video games and things now.
Yep.
I like Batgirl as a
me too.
Rooftop climber.
I like Oracle more,
but I'd rather have Oracle.
Yep. Yeah. And the team of she and Black Canary and their agents in Birds of Prey is also had proved to be a great team.
Yep. All right, so we're going to do spoilers now for post-Secret Wars Marvel. Not huge spoilers, because we don't actually know that much.
This is Marvel promo stuff, basically.
But if you don't want to know what's coming after Secret Wars at all, skip ahead to the comic section. You'll hear the music cue, and I've got, as always, the time in our show notes. But spoilers for a couple of images that Marvel posted and some speculation. So there were two teasers.
Yeah. The first one was...
They both have Iron Man at the center, notably at the center.
Centralized. The first one didn't have a ton of crazy stuff on it.
Yeah.
Well,
nothing we hadn't seen before, I guess.
Is that the one that had the three Inhumans?
So it's got Iron Man that says all new, all different Marvel. And the deal is that after Secret Wars, there's going to be 8 months. It's going to be 8 months from the
from when we saw
the future, which allows them to do a little some different stuff. And
all new number ones.
They're all new number ones, and they're going to be some different creative teams, that kind of thing.
And we're looking at is just a poster with a bunch of heroes on it, right?
Yeah. So Iron Man's in the center, and on the left you've got Phil Coulson, Spider-Gwen, Spider-Man, Spider-Woman, Black Panther, all new Cap, and then Steve Rogers in his super soldier uniform, but still old.
Yeah.
Right.
And then on the right you've got Ant-Man, Lady Thor, Miss Marvel, Vision. Miles Morales Spider-Man, and Red Wolf, an American Indian character, which led to a Twitter post that was my favorite thing ever, where someone was like, well, I'm really excited to see Marvel embracing diversity. Is that an engine with a bow and arrow?
Yeah.
And it is maybe a little politically incorrect of Marvel not to improve Red Wolf's costume a little bit.
The thing there,
but we don't have any context on what his character is.
But I believe, isn't he going to be in 1872, the Secret Wars?
Maybe so. And maybe
and
it's
I'm
sort of
throwback.
I'm pretty sure
that he's like the hero, and somehow he gets the list.
Okay. So that's our first, and that's all teasers for stuff we know about. S.H.I.E.L.D., Spider-Woman, this is all sort of the new Marvel that's been existing. And then they put a new one out, like the next day, and this one has a lot more. It's got, again, Iron Man in the center. Then off to the left, it's got a female character, looks to be Dr. Spectrum from the Squadron Supreme. Citizen V from Thunderbolts back in the 90s. The Thing wearing
the Guardians of the Galaxy outfit
with Rocket Raccoon standing on his shoulder. Who's the dude in the hoodie?
He is an Inhuman.
He's an Inhuman. Behind him, we have Human Torch. Is that right? Or is that Inferno or something?
I think it's Inferno. He's another Inhuman. Okay. They're really...
And then Hyperion, who from Avengers and other things. Medusa. Daredevil in sort of a more of a black and red costume.
More weirdly like the Netflix one.
And then X-23 in the Wolverine costume.
Yeah.
A guy who I'm not sure the guy in the jacket
Star-Lord?
Is. Star-Lord? Is that Star-Lord? Yeah, Star-Lord.
He's flipping his mask.
Yeah, Star-Lord. Doctor Strange with an axe.
Right.
And then Old Man Logan.
And the Doctor Strange axe, I asked on Facebook if that was the axe that Thor had been wielding, but it's not.
He has a one-bladed axe.
Yeah.
But this one seems, I mean, Thing being in Guardians, I'm not sure how I feel about that. I like the idea of Thing in a team, but I don't like anything Guardians has done.
The FF is disbanded, which is what I've been hearing.
Yeah.
And
I guess they are known as, among other things, space explorers.
Yeah, sure.
And, yeah, I don't really know who... I mean, Carol could probably bring him on there.
Well, you know, Ben Grimm, of course, used to have his own Marvel sort of team-up book. Marvel 2-in-1?
Uh-huh.
Which was essentially every issue, the Thing, and somebody.
Yep.
And the, so he teams up well with other characters. The, I could see him working well within the Guardians.
Yeah, I can too. I haven't liked the Guardians for a while, so I've...
But then, I think somebody else is taking over. I don't think Bendis is going to be writing it anymore.
But I might read it then.
And I think the other notable people on here is definitely Laura or X-23 as Wolverine.
Yep.
I'm
not sure that's what people want.
Sure if it's what people want, but I personally like...
Well, it's another bit of diversity. They've done pretty well sort of adding a lot more women to their comics.
Yeah.
What they need to add is more people of color. They still haven't added a ton. There's a few more, like Black Panther and Miles Morales are on there, the new Doctor Spectrum, I believe, may be black.
Yeah.
But they still haven't done much with Asian or Hispanic characters, unfortunately, and I wish they'd add a little bit more diversity in that as well.
Of these previews, I have actually had one or two customers mention the X-23 one to me.
Really?
So that may actually might have a little more weight than you think.
People did like that character.
It's a little anecdotal at this point. Now, here's a question. Do we think Wolverine himself will be back immediately, or do we think Old Man Logan?
Well, Old Man Logan's going to be there.
I think Old Man Logan is going to be the Wolverine of the Marvel Universe.
That's so weird.
But as I was sort of saying on whatever thread, I think it was a thread I posted on Facebook, it's an interesting story idea to basically confront him with the people that he's killed.
Yeah.
And I think a good writer can do a lot with that.
Yeah.
And it's not that I necessarily think Old Man Logan is a bad character. I think you can make a lot out of it. It's just... comes from a particularly story I don't care for.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, like, it's the kind of thing that I would probably used to say... would think I would like a storyline where he came back in time for a while.
Yeah.
Would be interesting. I don't know if I necessarily want him around for years.
Right.
But that is kind of more of the tradition now. Superior Spider-Man took over for a couple years.
But it's
and
also
they tend to run longer arcs like that.
It's sort of the Batman Beyond scenario.
He
is the sort of Bruce Wayne character to Laura's, you know.
Oh, that's Wolverine. Interesting. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
And if they take that route, I think it could be really, really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I'll be curious to see. These teasers mostly, I was not as thrilled with what I saw as I have been with most of the all-new Marvel teasers, but they've been on such a roll for me that I have pretty much a lot of faith in them.
The silliest thing is, I think I'm most excited about seeing Doctor Strange back in his regular outfit.
That's true. I forgot that he's not been wearing it.
Minus the giant axe that he's carrying, which, if Doctor Strange was to carry an axe,
you know,
sure.
He's Sorcerer Supreme. He can do what he wants.
I'm guessing it'll be something that comes out of Secret
but
Wars.
But I don't like his Marvel Now costume.
Me neither.
It's too wonky.
It's too generic.
It's too generic. And this with this
man
cape.
Man needs a cape.
A cape.
Also, I am most excited about Citizen V coming back because I like that costume. I like that character.
It's so bizarre.
Yeah.
Who the hell is Citizen V?
He turned out to be Baron Zemo.
Yeah, it was Zemo.
But he was the head of the Thunderbolts.
Right.
And he's just a guy with a sword who was a World War II hero, but it's a great costume that Mark Bagley designed.
Not like a Nazi?
Originally, he was a World War II hero. Zemo's dad killed him.
Yep.
And then when Zemo needed a heroic identity, he acted like he was the grandson of the original.
When all the villains became
when they pretended to be heroes.
Yeah, yeah. So this was straight out of Busiek.
Yeah, this is Busiek's Thunderbolts. Yep.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Busiek and
Bagley.
Bagley.
Yeah,
that's right.
So yeah, I liked that costume. I liked that character. So I'm curious to see what that means for the Thunderbolts, because they've gone quite a different direction. All right, that wraps up sort of our news for the week. We're going to be back in just a second to talk about comics for this week. All right, it is Comics for the Week of Wednesday, June 10th. And before we start, a bit of a disclaimer. Yes, we have not gotten our comics this week. Or we've gotten some of them, but not most of them. And so we are largely going off of, in Nick and my case, we have caught up on most of the Marvel stuff.
Digital previews and stuff.
Yeah, Nick and I have digital previews of Marvel. I have digital previews of Image. And I believe Dave is going to talk about a book from last week.
Something from last week. But we all have some notes and stuff on stuff we know is hitting tomorrow. Yeah. So we're going to talk about it.
So we're going to talk about a lot of stuff that we maybe haven't read yet. But we'll mention whether or not we've read it and talk about stuff that we're excited for. It's another big week. We're still in the midst of DC's big new number ones. Secret War is still rolling out. So there's a lot of stuff to talk about. But first of all, my pick for the week is an Image comic that I have read, Starve Number One. It's by Brian Wood and Denijel Zaselge.
Yep. That's Starve, Starve.
Yes.
Okay.
And this is it's a Brian Wood comic, which is to say it takes place in sort of a future where the 99% are being beaten down by the 1%.
Yep.
And there's...
That doesn't sound like the present at all.
There's global warming, and there's... you know, the poor have been forced to eat dog and all this kind of stuff. So the story focuses on a celebrity chef, sort of an Anthony Bourdain type, who has been living overseas for a few years, sort of disappeared, faked his death. And the network comes back to him. He created this show called Starve that is a big reality show where celebrity chefs would have to cook for the very, very rich. He vanished, and the network comes looking for him and says, "You owe us eight more shows." Very Spider Jerusalem and Transparent.
I was going to say, that's very Transparent.
So they drag him back into this world he wants no part of, and he finds out that his daughter, who he left behind, is now a 20-something, and she's a cook on the show. His old rival is the guy who's become the lead of the show. And it's this mix of political social commentary along with sort of a big cooking reality show.
As you say, like, conceptually, that dark future with celebrity chefs sounds like comedic almost.
Yeah, and it's not. It's very much a straightforward dark.
There's no comedic undertone at all.
No, not really. No, it's.
I mean,
not.
I generally don't know Brian Wood for doing comedies.
Say, Brian Wood does not.
No,
I'm just saying conceptually, it sounded like it could go that.
This is a book that sounds like if John Layman would do it, it would be hilarious.
Right.
Brian Wood is coming at it from a very serious point of view.
Okay.
But
pretty good stuff.
It's pretty good. I'm not always a big Zaselge fan on art, and I still think I can't tell his characters apart all that much. Yeah.
We've debated this a little over the years. I do like Daniel Zaselge. He's not like one of my favorites, but I do really like the look of his stuff.
Yeah,
sometimes the characters are a little difficult to distinguish.
It has a great look. His storytelling is solid. I just think his characters could use some work. But it is very interesting. Definitely recommend it. I think people will like this book. Nick, what are you picking for this week?
Yes. Unsurprisingly, I'm picking another Secret Wars title.
Sure.
Because, you know, the Secret Wars engine rolls on, and dear God, I'm having a lot of fun with it. So this week, I am going to pick the Marvel Zombies number one. yeah, I know, right? Written by Cy Spurrier, art by Kev Walker.
I had no idea what to make of this book. And that is to say, I haven't read it or anything, but I was just like, what are they going to do?
It's not really spoiling it, because they've already said it in a few books. Basically, the Marvel Zombies represent sort of the Deadlands, the sort of what's outside of Doom's world.
Right. Are they beyond his control?
It seems like. They don't have a Baron or anything, it seems like.
Well, it's not outside his control, but it's definitely something maybe he lost control of.
Right. It's definitely lawless territory you don't mess with.
But there may be... There's more to it than that. I'm not going to spoil it for people.
Okay.
But this book takes place about the characters that are on the shield, sort of the defense of
the wall, the big wall
that separates all the different kingdoms.
Yeah.
Right. And the main character is Elsa Bloodstone.
Yep.
Who is not exactly a well-known character in
Marvel. She's from Next Wave.
I was going to say, if you've read Next Wave, I think if you liked Next Wave at all, this is the book for you. Because it's written in sort of
that tone.
For those
who haven't, she's a monster hunter.
She's a monster hunter. She comes from a family of monster hunters. and she's sort of the take-no-nonsense, gun-toting, smack-you-in-the-jaw kind of person.
Snarky British lady.
Snarky British lady. And there is a lot of that in this book. Kev Walker draws it very, very well. I love his sort of take on things. They utilize the Marvel Zombies very well.
Yep.
But there's actually, it's more personal about her character. I was kind of surprised about the heart of it.
Well, this is basically a survival story.
It is a survival
story. I mean, I don't think it's a big spoiler to say that she basically gets stuck in the middle of the Deadlands.
Yeah, she gets stuck in the middle of the Deadlands and finds another character and sort of what they have to deal with in order to survive.
Well, knowing that, like, regular zombies are no picnic, but the Marvel zombies, like, have their powers and even intellect.
Yep. And they're intelligent and malevolent, yeah. They're more Army of Darkness, Evil Dead type stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So that would be a bad situation to be in.
Yeah. It is. And I think Sysperia does a great job of sort of executing that, and art was fantastic. I had a lot of fun with it. I think a lot of people will
flock to
this because the Marvel Zombies property
What's Kev Walker best known for?
He did
Thunderbolts.
But he also worked on some of the Annihilation books, didn't he?
Yes, I think he did. Okay. Yeah.
I remember liking his art. I just can't quite picture it in my head.
Yeah. This is definitely a, if you liked Marvel Zombies or you liked Next Wave, worth a look.
Yeah, I agree.
Dave, your pick is from last week.
Yep. I got a retro pick since I haven't read enough previews and things yet this week to determine. So I am backtracking to pick Action Comics number 41, the start of the new direction post-convergence for Superman.
Truth.
Now, we did talk about it. Yeah, the storyline is called Truth, and I gather is weaving between the various Superman-related titles.
Yeah, I think it's like this week sees a part of it in the new Batman-Superman story.
And it'll also be in Superman, Wonder Woman, and in the Superman book.
So, yeah, a little bit more of a throwback to like how they did the Superman books in the 90s, where a story would sometimes weave between Man of Steel and Superboy and Action Comics, and whatever. Anyway... it's interesting. I'd read a little bit of this last week when we did the podcast, but I wasn't sold on it. It begins with Superman wandering basically half naked in the woods. That is Clark Kent, kind of hurt, cold. He's clearly, his powers are diminished. And he finds a sort of a road stop kind of thing. And he gets inside and he's basically experiencing all the stuff that sort of, well, it's both the pleasure and pains of being human.
Right.
It's like getting inside and getting warm is a big thing for him.
Yeah.
He doesn't generally have to experience how cold things can get.
Yeah.
He's super hungry, and just eating a, like, burrito basically from a 7-Eleven is, like, the best thing he's ever
eaten. No, Dave, he's regular hungry. He's not in his powers.
Right.
Do I see him picking up a novelty shirt?
Yes. So the shirt that's on the cover of this, you know, people kind of joked about the bro look for him, because he does, which I think is something he did basically because his identity has, for reasons as yet not quite shown in detail, was sort of outed.
Yeah.
And so people know that Clark Kent is Superman, so he lost the this traditional kind of curly hair and S-lock and glasses. And yeah, he's got like sort of buzz cut his hair, and because he doesn't really have much to wear, he buys a cheap 70% off Superman shirt in this store and puts it on. That gives him the sort of visual identity, but most of the people don't recognize him. He ends up buying a motorcycle off of a dude at the gas station, and then it's the rest of the issue is sort of kind of concerned with him. There's some action, by the way. Some dudes try and jump him. Turns out his powers aren't completely gone, or they're on their way back. But he is basically at the old what I think of as the 1938 level Superman.
Yeah, yeah.
He can leap maybe over a building. He's got some super strength, but he is nowhere near the flight and
so he's back to what Morrison had him at the beginning of New 52.
Right, and he even looks kind of like that, so it makes some sense. The rest of the issue is concerned with his return to Metropolis, where he's known, and his like neighborhood where Clark Kent lived has been like quarantined because the government's like testing for alien infections and stuff like that. They've gotten paranoid. So here's the part that I didn't read, but that won me over, which is just that I thought it was kind of this sort of darker direction, and it is somewhat.
Sure.
But when he gets there, Jimmy Olsen is like, actually, we've got a surprise for you. And it turns out, like, there's this giant block party. Most of the people in the neighborhood, although there's some fear and paranoia, most of the people, they're throwing a big We Stand With Superman kind of thing. So where the government is a little bit very on edge, and there's been, like, lawsuits against him and all of this, basically the people are standing with him. And, you know, you see him hanging out. eating food. There's a new supporting character introduced. She's a lady who's a looks like on the she's a fireman. Mm-hmm. Who looks like a fun character. He's kind of clowning around with kids and stuff, and it was a much more upbeat scene. And then he gets a call for a dangerous thing on the docks he has to go deal with, so he does. There's some what I would consider full-on Superman action before the issue is out. But that general trend of him kind of getting through this adversity, he does feel a bit more human in it, but it's an approach I like. It does remind me sort of the early Morrison issues.
He's not sort of toiling in emotion.
No, he's
Superman?
He's not angsting about it. He's a little bit like, he's like, yeah, my world's turned a little bit upside down, but he's like, if there's danger, I'm still going there. And the people, you know, seem to be kind of with him. So
cool.
Very cool.
I liked it. Oh, the art by Chris, not Chris Burnham, but it reminds me of Chris Burnham, Aaron Cooter.
Yeah.
Is a huge part of the draw. He's been working with writer Greg Pak for most of Greg Pak's run. He has a style reminiscent a little bit of Frank Quitely or Chris Burnham, a little bit of that European style.
Yep.
And there's really beautiful coloring on it, actually, like very nice backgrounds, and it's sort of a subtle muted palette that, you know, again, I would not normally want on Superman.
Right.
But this more reminds me of, like, say, Scott Collins in the early days of Jeff Johns' epic Flash run, where that book felt very classic superhero, but it did have a sort of muted palette to it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so recommend people check it out and see what they think.
All right, so there's a big stack of stuff this week as well to talk about. Also on my list this week, from Image, Copperhead number 8, Saga number 29, which I believe finishes up the current Saga story, and then a whole bunch of Marvel stuff. There's Kane and the Last Battle on number 3. I've been really enjoying that book.
Such a great series.
Mrs. Deadpool and the Howling Commandos number 1, which is very much a Secret Wars continuation of the Deadpool book that was going. Jerry Duggan's still writing. It focuses on Deadpool's left-behind wife. Deadpool's ghost narrates it. Like, if you were reading Deadpool, this is the book you want to jump in on. There's Secret Wars 2099 number 2, which leads more into the Secret Wars Avengers, or the 2099 Avengers, which is really interesting. Their Captain America has a really interesting secret identity, which I liked a lot and is sort of explored in this issue. Silk number 5, which, again, Stacy Lee, the artist of that book, will be here in about 3 weeks.
Yep.
Spider-Verse number 2, which I like quite a bit and features Spider-Ham interacting with Spider-Gwen. And then, of course, Ms. Marvel Volume 3 trade comes out that week, this is one of my favorite books. And then also a couple DC books that caught my attention. Earth 2 Society number 1, which is a reprint launching of the Earth 2 book now that Earth 2 has been destroyed.
Yeah.
And then Section 8, number 1, which is a return of the great misanthropic super team of Hitman. Yes.
Yeah. It's Garth Ennis's crazy DC superhero team, including Six-Pack, the Defenestrator, and Dogwelder.
It
also has John McCrae returning for art.
And then there's some trades and hardcovers. The Absolute Transmet hardcover, Transmetropolitan, which I'm picking up. We may not have for the shelf, but we will have back in if someone's interested in it. It's a pricey volume, and I think 100 or 125 bucks, but it's gorgeous looking.
If you're a true fan.
Yep. The Batgirl of Burnside hardcover finally comes out, and that's really cool. That's
I'll be excited to read all those back-to-back.
Yeah. And, of course, BPRD 1946-48 hardcover, which collects all the various World War II era BPRD stuff, the early days, pre-Hellboy, interesting stuff, which I know Nick has also read and enjoyed.
I haven't read all of them, which is, I'm kind of really looking forward to sort of sitting down with that one.
Nick, what else is on your list?
A lot of Marvel, some DC, so I've got 1602 number 1. Witch Hunter Angela. I enjoyed it, and it's sort of take on what it is in Secret Wars. Ghost Racers number 1.
Yep.
Ghost Rider Arena.
Yes, Ghost Rider Arena and Arcade. So there you go.
Arcade as the sort of announcer for it seems like an ingenious throw-in.
Yeah, is that
part of Killville or is that a different?
No, it's on the outskirts of Doomstadt.
But they still call their Colosseum the Killosseum.
Sorry. The 8th issue of Birthright, which I thought was really, really good. The new series Starfire from DC by Jimmy Palmiotti and the art by... I actually don't know who the artist is.
I didn't know who it was, but when I was reading through it, it was really nice.
Yeah, I would actually say it is extremely nice.
I think it's a good fun one for folks to check out.
Yeah.
It's a good sort of all-ages-ish superhero thing. The The sexy time stuff with her has been toned down for a sort of a lighter touch.
It's a lighthearted affair.
There is a little bit of it, but she's definitely not wearing. In fact, she even at some point in there, somebody suggests, you know, a bikini because she sees one in the window and she's like, "Oh, that looks pretty." And you know, they're like, "Oh, you should wear that," because they're sort of doing the stranger in a strange land, freshly arrived on.
Sure, okay.
And so somebody else is like, "I don't think you want to be wearing that. That's like less than, you know, like dental floss." And
maybe a little knock
at some of their missteps.
There were a few times I felt like they were breaking sort of the fourth wall.
Maybe a little meta commentary on a character who's been at the heart of a little bit of DC controversy.
Yep.
But this was definitely a direction that I would prefer.
Oh yeah.
And fun art as well. So worth checking.
The second issue of Inhumans: Attila and Rising. I'm really into the Inhumans at the moment, and Charles Soule just continues to get better and better. I have not read, but I'm very much looking forward to Captain Marvel and the Carol Corps tomorrow to read. Constantine the Hellblazer gets a relaunch with the new number one.
Yep.
Do we know anything about the direction?
Nope.
The only thing I know is that it's Riley Rosno on art. And he is the guy who did Proof.
Okay.
A few other Image books. He's been
around.
Oh,
that could be
fun. Yeah. I think he's got a great art style that fits with Constantine.
We know, Dave, that our copies are in Dallas right now.
There's also the second volume to the Chuck Dixon Nightwing.
Oh, awesome.
Yep.
Entitled Rough Justice.
Yep.
Rough Justice.
And then I did want to save the best for last because it's like my cheater pick.
Yep, sure.
And come on, you have to have a cheater pick.
Sure.
This is also Secret Wars, but this is Secret Wars Journal number 2.
Yep.
Mainly because both stories in it were fantastic.
Yeah. I agree. I read this one as well.
I don't want to spoil too much, but the second one featuring Daredevil...
It's a take on Daredevil we've never seen.
Yeah, is very, very out of left field, and I think executed extremely well.
Yep.
Just a tease... Daredevil and Mr. Sinister, what would you do?
Yep.
And you'll never guess this one.
Nope.
But I really, really recommend picking up that. I love seeing these smaller vignettes of Secret Wars of Battle World. And I'm enjoying it. Dave, what do you got?
I'll do the quick rundown. There's Harrow County number 2.
Yeah, we all like that first issue.
On Dark Horse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And Lantern City number 2 from Archaea.
Yeah.
They're sort of their dystopian steampunk world.
Right.
Descender number 4, one of my favorite series running
right
now.
Which I've read and is really good.
Great sci-fi series that everybody should be reading with beautiful painted art. DC launches their new Suicide Squad book, so I know that's going to be of interest to a lot of people.
No, it is number 9.
It's number 9, but it'll sort of be the new direction.
Right.
And probably a new team lineup, I bet. Likewise, Gotham Academy has its first New Direction issue with issue 7, and we know that Damian, Batman's son, is coming to the Gotham Academy.
Yep.
That stands to be a very fun shakeup, and I imagine he'll be a good foil for the characters.
Yeah.
When I read through the first several issues recently, I actually enjoyed a lot about him, but I found that the characters needed a little more definition.
Yeah.
And I actually think playing off such a well-known character as Damian could really help with that.
Right.
There's Rebels number 3, the Brian Wood Revolutionary War book. So I've been enjoying that one. Let's see, Silver Surfer Volume 2 collection. That's Dan Slott's Silver Surfer run, which I would most liken to kind of a cosmic Marvel take on Doctor Who.
Okay,
with the Silver Surfer as the Doctor and a woman from Earth sort of as his companion.
Yep.
It has some of the lightness of Doctor Who, but also sometimes the big cosmic seriousness. So it's a book I've kind of continued to recommend. And I haven't read the second volume yet, but I enjoyed picking up the first one as a late arrival. So I'm going to definitely check it out. Last thing on my list is the reprints of the first 4 issues of Squirrel Girl.
Yep.
My favorite humorous comic of the last of the new year.
Love that comic.
These covers awesomely, they all have a theme going on. Yep. She has a certain battle slogan.
Yep.
And that slogan is,
eats nuts, kicks butts.
Yes. And each issue, of this has one of those. So there is,
kicks and butts.
Butts, yes. So if you want to own like just issue 4 and reprint, you can have an issue that just says butts on a giant on the cover, and it's awesome. As bizarre as it is, it perfectly fits the silliness of the book, which I think we'd all recommend.
Yep.
So if you've been missing out on it, try the first issue. It's awesome.
Yep. All right, that'll wrap up our comics talk for this week, and we'll be back in just a second with some movie and TV and game and all kinds of other stuff we're going to talk about. All right, so before we get into all our topics this week, we've been saving these for a couple weeks as we've been so loaded down with other topics.
Right, so...
Talking about comics and news and stuff.
We're going to unclog the drain.
That's right, unclog the topic drain.
Yep.
There's got to be a better way to put that.
Oh, it's gross.
All right, but before we do that, Nick, you were going to mention a new book, new comic or new game that came in the store this week.
Yes, I was. Mainly because we love the original so much. I mean, yep. I've played it multiple times. I know Randy has.
Yep.
And it's also been a huge mover at the store, so clearly lots of people like it.
But Boss Monster 2 sees its release this week.
And standalone game.
It is a standalone game.
Or expansion if you have the original.
Yeah, you can use it as both.
Yep. None of us have gotten a chance to play it, considering it just came in.
Brand new, yeah.
But wanted to let people know that it was in, and come get it.
Yeah, because I did do a quick write-up for it when I posted about it on Facebook yesterday. I know that there's, like, I want to say, like, 8 or 10 or so, like, new bosses.
Yep.
There's new trap and room cards. There's new, like, epic heroes and something they call dark heroes, I think. Yep. So it's going to have some, like, fun new options as well as just more cool bosses.
It also has that silver packaging. It looks like a classic Nintendo cartridge.
Yes, it looks like an NES cartridge.
Yes. So, and also, as our staffer Amanda pointed out, Boss Monster works perfectly with the B-52's tune, Rock Lobster. You're welcome.
In fact, that was I who pointed that out.
It was you that pointed that out?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
She was the one who dug up Rock Lobster and played it on the store.
Oh, okay. Kind of looks like Amanda Anderson.
They're basically the same person.
I'm right here, Randy.
Okay.
Can't go around my back with that one.
All right. Dave, you were going to talk about something that your brother has been getting.
Right. So I came across on Facebook like a year or two ago of somebody had liked something called The Mysterious Package Company, just an acquaintance of mine. I followed it, and I even asked him, I'm like, what is it? It seems cool just by looking at their website. And he's like, I actually haven't done it, but it does look neat. He just somehow chanced across it and liked it.
Yeah.
So when I looked into it, it turns out it's essentially a kind of a gift-giving website that offers up sort of a unique, kind of eerie experience told through... mail and crates and stuff that you get in the mail. Mm-hmm. Think of a loot crate of sort, but that came with what looked like authentic documents indicating some mystery or something, some sort of sinister supernatural doings.
Right, right.
And indeed, they're a little pricey, and right now they have, I think, like 3 or 4 what they call experiences for sale.
Okay.
With more in the works, and one or two like slightly less expensive ones. But I'll say that they're in the... The less expensive ones are probably going to run around $100.
Okay.
And the more expensive ones are going to be a little over $200 with tax and stuff.
Okay.
So there's not something to kind of casually do, but if you were looking for a cool gift for the person in your life who likes horror or strangeness or letters, I got one for my brother, and he has now received all of them, and we were very happy with it.
Okay.
The big ones come over the course of three mailings. You get sort of like an initial one that's generally just like normal, what would you call it, just letters and things like that, postal stuff. And then a second one with more that might be like a folder with lots of stuff in it, or like a variety of them. And ultimately a crate with like nails that you got to pry out with a crowbar.
Yep.
And like it generally contains something at the heart of the mystery.
Okay.
But without saying too much about this one, the one, because, you know, they do operate on the sort of the secrecy.
Yeah, sure.
I knew a little about what I was giving, and essentially it begins with a letter that was addressed to my brother that indicated that he was, in fact, a distant relative of this woman who had defected from the Soviet Union in the 70s after working on an island that was where they were doing sort of scientific experiments.
Right, right.
And they are trying things got crazy. I guess I'll put it that way. I don't want to say exactly what happened, but... It has a sort of authenticity when you see these things. The letters are all, they have that aged look. They use actual stamps from, like, so there were Russian stamps on this. And my brother looked up the stuff in Cyrillic. You can investigate, generally, whatever you're getting.
That's cool.
And, you know, they don't translate everything for you, although there is a lot of it. The key stuff is translated, of course. Or you'll have a letter that somebody is explaining what it is. But he looked it up, and it's, like, all legitimate.
Huh.
They really go to their work. And like, the island that this takes place on, it's a real island. There was, like, in the early 70s, it was, like, quarantined for, like, a smallpox outbreak. And of course, the story that he learns through these mails is that that was a cover for something much more sinister.
Right.
I don't want to reveal what happened.
Yeah, sure.
Came
no,
at the
no.
very end. But suffice to say, it will be a piece of memorabilia that would be awesome to display at Halloween.
Oh, okay.
It's very creepy, but also awesome. And I felt it was well worth the price that I paid.
Oh, nice.
And in fact, Nick will be receiving one in a few months. That is one of the single crate ones.
Okay.
But from what I know, I believe this one is going to be a book of sorts.
Well, you told me the lead time on it, and it is insane.
Well, it's like 2 months in advance, as it turns out. And I don't know. I believe it's probably because, like, the way they sort of create the weathering and stuff on these, it looks really real. Like, it doesn't look like... I've created some documents for role-playing games in my time.
Yep.
I've used soaked things in iced tea to make them look weathered.
Sure.
And it looks cool, but it doesn't necessarily look completely authentic.
Right, right.
So these things look really authentic. Like, there were old faded typing paper pages that were in some of the documents that had, you know, like, imprints from an actual typewriter on it.
Yeah.
There were things that were clearly signed by real people, the photographs that were on old Polaroids from, like, the 70s. They really go out of their way to make it feel authentic, and so I can believe the lead time. I don't know quite what it is you're getting into, Nick, but I guess you will have to tell us.
I sort of tried to explain all of this to my wife, and she was like, I don't quite get it. I mean,
yeah.
And I have this fear that it's going to freak her out, and she's going to be like, oh my god, I can't touch it, or anything like that, because they do go to this length of... Because I've only seen a few
of the
props.
I was warned, by the way, that this one contains some intense themes.
Oh, okay.
So I'm super excited, because I am a fan of horror.
Well, I knew that y'all both like horror movies.
Yeah.
I don't think, like, this is not like Michael Douglas in The Game. Y'all aren't going to get phone calls or anything, but it will suggest some sort of real link between you and probably whatever this is.
Yeah. And I think that's going to be awesome.
Yes, I'm very excited about it. So I got to, of course, in buying these for people, I get to look at what they're getting. And
oh,
it's really
I see
cool.
how it is.
Yes. Well, you just need to go by my brother's place and you can check out all this stuff.
Well, I will say, I went on their website and you basically just get a front page.
Yes.
You don't get any to look at any of the packages. You have to be accepted into their thing. And I didn't want that.
Yeah.
But I did find it very cool that there is a quote on the front page from a notable comic guy. Saying that this is the best gift you can give anybody.
Huh.
That person is Chris Burnham, which was really kind of stoked to see, because I have followed Chris Burnham on a few things, and I'd never seen him mention it, and I'm super excited.
So when I joined the group, and before I could look at what they had to sell, I had to like fill out sort of a questionnaire.
Yeah,
the questionnaire is actually nothing too bizarre, but I'm like they're asking who you might want to give it as a gift to. Tell us a little bit about them. Not like write up a paragraph, but you like might indicate I think an interest or two. But it also asks for their blood type.
Okay.
And I feel like that was just them having a bit of fun. But like there is like that's what's kind of cool about these guys is there is that bizarre macabre element to them. So I highly recommend it.
Oh, cool.
Just based on what I've seen so far.
So I recently played the DC deck building game.
Yeah, I've been curious about this one since forever.
Which I really liked. I have a friend who's been talking it up, and he had the basic game with the Heroes Unite expansion, which adds more heroes and that kind of thing. And basically, this is a deck building game in the vein of Star Realms or Dominion. If you played either one of those, you're going to catch up. You're going to pick up on the rule on the game mechanics really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a main hero who's your character who has a special ability. I was playing Booster Gold, who got a +1 whenever
you get
he played.
To choose your character?
Yeah. Of course, it's just Booster Gold. And you get a +1 whenever you play a defense card. So anything that defense on, I got a bonus out of.
Uh-huh.
And so it's like any of these resources.
Like force field?
Yeah.
Indicating.
So any of these resource games basically is a you're using the resource the cards give you resources to buy more cards.
Right.
And then what you're supposed to be doing is there's a stack of supervillains, and every time when you buy a supervillain, you get that supervillain who has just a cool, powerful ability that goes in your deck. But also it flips over the next supervillain on the list.
Uh-huh.
And that supervillain has an instant effect. Anything from like everybody loses a card to everybody takes a damage card and puts it in their deck, that kind of thing, depending on. So every time you reveal a new villain, something happens to everybody at the table.
Cool.
And as that progresses, those villains are more expensive than any other cards in the game, but basically you're all trying to buy them because they also offer victory points. And at the end, your you look at your deck and you figure out how many victory points you have, whether it's the supervillains or, for example, if you have Green Arrow, Green Arrow's worth nothing unless you have four other heroes, in which case it's worth 5 points. So just to represent sort of a teamwork kind of thing.
I gotcha.
That kind of thing. And then you buy villains, heroes, powers, bases, equipment, all that kind of stuff, and play that throughout. We had a Batman who was desperately trying to get his cape and cowl, but we kept buying it out from underneath him before he could get it. We had a Black Canary, and Black Canary gets bonuses when she plays either heroes or villains, so she was gathering up both of those. Mm-hmm. She gets points for villains, so she got extra. And then Martian Manhunter, if he plays a hero and a villain, gets a bonus. So he was using both, sort of okay. representing shape changing, that kind of thing. There's a bunch of different heroes with different abilities, but the basics are you buy equipment, villains, powers, heroes, and you play them until you've managed to capture all the various supervillains.
Nice.
It's really fun. I'm a little sad that all the art is New 52 art, but it is well done. It's well chosen.
Sure.
And it's really quick to play. And if you enjoy the deck building games, you like the DC Comics, I'm actually very much looking forward to playing this again. I really enjoyed it.
I know conceptually it's kind of different from, say, Marvel's Legendary game.
Yeah.
Is that in that one you are S.H.I.E.L.D. agents recruiting heroes to deal with villain threats. And in this, you are the hero.
Yeah, you're playing a hero. And I think the notion is basically, like, when a villain pops up, it's not like Marshmallow used Poison Ivy against the rest of us.
Right.
It's that Poison Ivy came up.
Giving them a threat.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It was really good, and we should definitely play that again. Nick, you have been catching up on an old series.
I have. When did the... I'll say what it is first, and then I'll ask my question.
Yes.
It is The Wire from HBO.
Yep.
When did it first air?
I don't know. 90s?
Okay. No, it was like early 2000s.
Maybe so. I'll look it up. You keep talking.
But no, I had never watched it.
I'm going to say 2004, by the way.
Oh, there's a bet, huh?
All right.
No, I had never seen this. I don't know where I was when it originally came out.
I've only seen like a couple episodes, so I've always wanted to see it.
But I've heard from not only Randy, but from a lot of people, basically have put this as their most favorite show ever.
2002, by the way.
2002.
And I wouldn't say it's not my favorite show ever. My favorite show ever is either Terriers or Breaking Bad.
Okay.
But
I've heard you speak of it in those, like, almost at those levels.
Though. It is widely regarded as the best television show ever done, and I can't necessarily argue with that. It may not be my favorite, but it is one I like, and it is definitely a show that is probably the pinnacle of what TV can accomplish.
And you and I usually have, I mean, close taste in television. And
yeah.
For the most part, you like some darker stuff that I don't.
And you like procedural stuff that I don't.
Right. But you said you had a hard time getting into this show?
At first I did, yeah.
And I always thought I would experience the same thing, but from episode one, I'm in.
You were hooked?
I like the characters. I like the mixture of sort of, I mean, it's very realistic and sort of the portrayal of Baltimore cops.
So for those who haven't watched it, what's the basics of Baltimore season one Wire?
Basically, it's just cops versus mob in a lot of ways.
But it's not the mob. It's more of it's like a drug kingpin.
It's a drug kingpin. Up and coming guys. A group of people that weren't on anybody's radar at all, except for one guy. And he's sort of, the instigator is he talks to a friend who is a judge. And that starts a kind of shitstorm.
Yeah.
And cops get dragged into this that they don't want.
Yep. Well, and it's called The Wire because it's about surveillance.
They
set up a surveillance unit for this drug crew.
And the drug crew actually has a really cool, unique way of communicating with each other because they are very against like cell phones.
Uh-huh.
So they've actually gone back a little bit and used pagers.
Huh.
And sort of use a code with pagers that I actually thought was really, really interesting. There's some interesting stuff with the cops figuring that out.
Yep.
And sort of these group of cops that are sort of just misfits and screw-ups. Because they are.
Yep.
And you see them screw up, and then you see them kind of redeem themselves a little bit. But I actually like one of the main guys, whose name is McNulty on the show. I don't know his real name.
You've seen him as Dominic West.
He's been
in a variety of different things.
He's a British actor.
He's a British actor, but he's playing very Baltimore American.
Yeah,
very well.
I always remember. I did not know until I saw him in, I don't know, like Stardust or something else, and he was in how British he was.
And McNulty, by the way, is a terrible person. He's a drinker. He's a womanizer. He's a guy who has an ego. He gets the cop. He basically gets this all started because of his ego. He can't let this go.
Yeah, he is a horrible person in a lot of regards, but I still see him as, I mean, not the hero, I mean, essentially,
he's the protagonist.
But he's the protagonist. He's the one that he wants to catch the bad guys.
Yeah.
And you know, he'll go to
a little more driven, maybe
a little more driven. And I love the lieutenant, which I always forget his name.
He was on Fringe.
But yeah, Fringe. Tons of things that you'll see. You'll recognize him right off the bat. He's amazing. And of course, it's got, for its villains, Idris Elba.
Yep, playing Stringer Bell.
My God. Every time he's on the screen, I'm like, he's
by awesome. The way, you say villains, but honestly, The Wire is very much not... This is not a cops and robbers show.
No.
This is showing sort of... These are guys in sort of the projects...
Definitely getting both sides of the story. Yeah, right?
These are guys... This is based on a miniseries, The Corner, done by David Simon, who is the executive producer and also was a journalist. And he's got one of his the co-producers on it is a former cop, and it's definitely showing that sort of, you know, in poverty and these projects that the drug dealing was sort of the way to make money. It didn't make any sense for them to do anything else.
Yeah, it's a realistic appraisal and not a kind of simplified.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't want to. I mean, I was simplifying a little bit as sort of cops and
and the funny thing is, as you go on, you will find that it expands in scope, but to be about sort of the corruption of the system and that kind of thing as well. So.
When I hear people talk about The Wire, not having seen it, it seems like that is the prevailing quality of it, is that sort of that sense of, well, sort of a crushing sense of systemic abuses, and like that this is like sort of a never-ending cycle, that there is no like white knight that can come in and sort fix.
This is not a show that's going to make you feel great.
No, the horrible politics of the sort of Baltimore Police Department and, you know, the insane things that go on between like the hierarchies of lieutenants and majors or whatever you want to, whatever rank they are.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the stuff they do is horrible.
Yep.
Wanting people to inform on each other because they're not doing what they're supposed to, or they're going, they're doing more than they should.
Nick, you are into season one, right?
I am on episode 8.
So you have seen the famous scene with McNulty and the Bunk. The Bunk, by the way, one of the best characters ever created. Yeah. He's played by Wendell Pierce, and the scene where the two of them figure out the murder.
Yeah.
And it's a long extended sequence of them just dropping the F-bomb over and over again, and in doing so, revealing what they're figuring out about the murder.
It's an amazing scene.
It's a great scene.
I've seen this scene on YouTube, and so I know the scene you're talking about. It is a pretty amazing sequence.
And
That is the scene where I fell in love with the show.
Yeah, I mean, there were some other scenes before that, but I found that to be amazing.
You know, when this came out, Randy, and I remember where we were watching, like, maybe the tail end of The Shield, I think was going on at the time. And I think the Wire felt it was less sexy in the sense that it was not as demonstrative as The Shield was. The Shield was always kind of like had a certain infectious energy because the strike team was like, they were these corrupt cops, but it was a weird way. It was almost like you were kind of hanging out with friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were kind of maybe bad people, but they were kind of your friends too.
Yeah.
And so there was this energy running through it that The Wire didn't immediately have.
Right.
But it's just a different vibe.
Yeah.
You know, it's certainly not shooting for what The Shield had.
No, no.
Although they are both exploring sort of corruption in very different ways.
Sure.
The Wire feels very more, I mean, more human in a lot of ways. I mean, The Shield is very heightened, I think.
Right.
Yeah, The Wire is definitely
kind of a little more melodramatic.
The Wire is definitely kind of character focused.
Yeah. No, but I'm loving it. You've told me that the second season brings basically there's a huge turn,
a big change, and there's a lot of that. Season 4 features a lot of characters you won't see yet.
Yeah.
And it's my favorite season.
What are you watching it on, Nick?
HBO Go.
Okay.
Yep. Actually, I'm flip-flopping between HBO Go and Amazon Prime.
Right, because it's on both. Yeah.
And just whatever room I happen to be in.
Yep.
Yeah, it's nice that HBO put a lot of their stuff on Prime. I was surprised by that, honestly, but a lot of it's on there.
Dave, I see that this weekend that you saw the final Studio Ghibli film. I think it's the third final Studio Ghibli film they've done.
I don't know. Actually, I think is that how they've announced it, or is it more like Miyazaki has done his final thing? But
I think they've said that too.
Yeah, but I heard this might be the last Studio Ghibli film.
We'll see.
The movie is called When Marnie Was There.
Yeah,
I think I don't have it written down, but I believe that's what
you told me.
That sounds right.
So you're wrong.
I didn't know much about this. It's based on, I believe, a sort of young adult novel. Mm-hmm. And it has that sort of quieter, gentler feel that, you know, people know is this sort of trademark Studio Ghibli approach in a lot of ways. It's essentially, it's sort of realistic, but with a supernatural, a realistic thing about a young girl, but there is a supernatural element. I don't know. I'm trying to recall when it's set. It's not, I want to say, quite in present time, but I feel like it could be like, is it maybe like the 40s or 50s? A lot of Miyazaki stuff feels like period pieces.
Yeah.
Even sometimes when they're not, I think they feel like it.
They sort of have a timeless quality to them.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
She's a sort of slightly antisocial, kind of introverted girl who, and I'm going to say she's maybe around 13 or 14, who has sort of bad asthma and gets sent off to this sort of like live in this sort of rural area with some relatives. I sort of like, I think an aunt and an uncle. What's the name? John C. Reilly voices the uncle, and is
okay.
They're very, a very nice couple, kind of a little bit wacky, and they take little snipes at each other, but it's sort of in this loving way, and they're this very,
sounds very Miyazaki.
Yep. It's very grounded in them, and what the girl finds is, you know, this is something of a, you know, not quite a coming of age story, but that's the overall vibe as she's sort of learning how to deal with kind of her own antisocial tendencies. Even as she's exploring, there's a big lake near her and sort of a swamp, not a swamp type area, but there's an old house that you can only get to when the tide is out. And what she'll do is she goes to visit it, and she begins meeting this girl named Marnie, who is about her age and seems to have lived, you know, maybe it's in modernish times, and Marnie's flashbacks look like they're in the 40s.
Okay.
But she has some sort of darkness in her past that is slowly revealed over the course of the film. The ghost stuff is not scary ghost stuff. It is more of a sort of a means of getting to the drama. There is a mystery that is revealed over the course of the movie, especially towards the end. And it's a pretty satisfying mystery. But a lot of the movie is about the drama of these two girls sort of bonding between their different eras.
Okay.
And the character growth that kind of emerges from that. It's very sweet. It's unlike a lot of American movies, it does have that sort of gentle quality, and it sort of unfolds at its own pace.
Yeah.
You know, don't expect either sort of the Pixar or Disney approach, but I really liked it. In fact, it's sort of grown on me in the thinking of it, so I'm intending to buy it when it comes out.
Okay.
But
are there any cat buses?
There are no cat buses.
Are there any Totoros?
There's actually the animation is really beautiful in this one. I noticed that there was sort of a broader variety of sort of character types. Miyazaki sort of used certain similar looks, almost like as if he was casting the same actors in different movies, and they were just models, character models for animation. This one he's not involved in, except maybe, I don't know, maybe as a producer. But it's not, it's Ghibli, Studio Ghibli, but not Miyazaki.
Okay.
And so the characters, I thought took on a wider variety of looks. There's stockier people. There are more distinctly, I guess I'd say, Asian faces, where Miyazaki kind of had a European look to much of his stuff.
Sure.
And I sort of enjoyed the variety. It was nice to see. Oh, it's got a great voice cast. I forget. I'm going to forget everybody who does voices for it other than John C. Reilly.
Yeah.
But very, very strong dubbing, which is not always the case, but Disney tends to do a good job in translating.
Yeah.
For the most part, the Miyazaki films that I've seen have had really good dubbing.
Yeah, they generally do pretty good dub cuts.
On occasion, there's been ones that I've been like, that didn't quite work. I'm trying to remember, I saw one with Dan that we were like...
Oh, Castle in the Sky did have a pretty weak dub with Anna Paquin, I think, as a...
That's right.
On-again, off-again southern accent. And you're like, that's not good.
But I mean, like, Spirited Away is amazing.
Porco Rosso has Michael Keaton.
Yeah. They've done a lot of good choices. Randy, to answer your cat bus question, it's not that kind of movie. It is primarily realistic with only little... The ghost is the only sort of... unusual thing about it. So there are no creatures.
No, I just asked that question about every movie. Was there any cat buses in Fast and Furious 7?
How about The Martian? Is that going to have
The Martian
going to
have a cat bus? that would be a slight diversion from the material, but...
Hayao Miyazaki's The Martian.
I mean, I'm not saying... I just think most movies would be improved by addition of a cat bus.
I can't disagree with
that. I mean, don't you think?
I would like for a cat bus to have gone in and destroyed Transformers.
Yeah, I agree. I would totally. I might see a Transformers movie if cat bus was in it. All right, so we're going to close out here with a spoiler. So if you have not seen the Fox show Wayward Pines, we are up through episode 4 at this recording. We are going to possibly spoil things from that. So,
but I think I can also talk about around the major spoilers.
But we're not going to. So
okay.
If you have not listened, if you have not watched Wayward Pines and you intend to, pause. and come back to us later. The only thing you're going to miss is our sign-off. But if you have, please listen in as we talk Wayward Pines episodes 1-4. Okay. So first of all, this is a show on Fox.
Yes.
I'm watching on my DVR. Nick is watching on his DVR. How are you watching the show, Dave?
Through their website.
Oh, okay.
They all have, at last check, all four episodes were available for viewing through the website.
To go up at midnight kind of deal?
It must be something like that. Yeah. I don't even know what day it comes on.
Thursdays.
Thursdays. Okay. So if I want to see episode 5, which you saw in advance, Randy, I would have to wait till Thursday night Friday,
depending
on when they post it.
Midnight Thursday or whatever, so... This is a show that is a 10-episode event series.
Mm-hmm. Based on a trilogy of novels.
Based on a trilogy of novels called Wayward Pines. And I did talk to the executive producer at ATX Fest, and he said...
What a big man.
Yeah. he said that this is... I asked him, is there more? Because the ratings have been good.
Yeah.
Especially for a summer series. And he said, you know, we've talked about it, but honestly... All three books are covered in this 10 episodes. It is a ending. There's not a big cliffhanger ending. This is an ending. So you're going to get a good, complete series, which makes me more interested. When I know...
I suppose, imagine if Lost had only been 10 episodes and they had to like get all the goods out there in 10 episodes.
Yeah,
Lost couldn't have pulled it off.
No.
But it might have... It certainly would have cut out like all conceivable fat. It has to be hardcore plot driven.
Well, Wayward Pines is very... it reminds me of something from Lost, Twin Peaks. I got a little bit of Shirley Jackson's The Lottery in there.
I've heard people mention The Prisoner.
The Prisoner. Mm-hmm. So basically, it has an amazing cast. It's led by Matt Dillon. Carlo Gugino is a major player.
Yep.
There's also Terrence Howard, Melissa Leo.
Who's the guy who's the psychiatrist?
Toby Jones.
Who you might know as...
From Camp
Zola.
As Arnim Zola.
Right.
There's also Hope Davis shows up in the fourth episode. By the way, they said that
you
she was...
Juliette Lewis, right?
And Juliette Lewis, yeah. And a grown-up Juliette Lewis. It's crazy.
Yes, it's a little bit weird to see her as somebody who's, like, what, in her 40s, I guess?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, Hope Davis was originally only going to be in for 2 episodes, but they loved her so much that she's in all remaining 7.
Is she the nurse?
No, she's the school teacher.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Melissa Leo is the nurse, and she is Oscar winner Melissa Leo, who has been in everything from... Treme on HBO, where she played sort of a crusading lawyer, which she was great as. She was in Louis as sort of a date that he had. She's been all over the place. You've seen her in a ton of stuff, and she is playing so creepy and terrifying in this.
So we should probably say I think we've all liked it.
Yes,
like maybe even really liked it.
It's my favorite summer watch right now.
And this is funny, and I just want to say because. You didn't think you were going to like it.
I did not. I watched the first episode, and I was like, well, it's okay.
A lot of people, by the way, were worried just because Shyamalan, I believe, M. Night Shyamalan, produces it and directed the first episode.
Here is what Shyamalan's involvement is. He directed it. He directed the first episode.
Does he not
He's listed as a producer, but that's just because of who he is.
But his name is rather toxic.
Yes.
And I would hate for people to miss out just because of that.
Well, Fox made the mistake of promoting it with his name, but honestly, this is not his production. This is the novelist whose name is something like Barty Creech.
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly what it is. But this was a show that was written on spec by Chad Hodge, the producer.
Uh-huh.
He read the novels, he fell in love with them, and he wrote the script on spec and pitched it. This doesn't happen. This is a weird way for
what on spec means.
It wasn't a deal.
I see.
He just wrote it and then pitched it to networks.
Right. And they're like, this looks neato.
Yeah, that never happens. And then he got Shyamalan on board to direct one. But Shyamalan directed one episode. This is not a Shyamalan joint.
Right. And I think even if you are not a fan of the twists and turns of his writing, you would probably say his movies are all well-directed.
Yeah, the mood is good. It looks good.
And he knows how to do paranoid mood, which is very much at the heart of the show, which, you know, when you're talking about its influences, it's essentially a creepy small town.
Yeah, creepy small town, creepy hospital.
Yes, and a place that you can't get out of.
Yeah.
Well, I will say the first episode is a little hodgepodge. There's a lot happening.
Yeah, they have a lot of characters to introduce.
Yeah, and a lot of things to do. So I can see why some people were a little... It left you feeling a little cold.
Well, the paranoia stuff in the first episode and the conspiracy stuff going on, I liked all of it because I liked that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also sort of felt like, well, I've seen a town where like people are looking through their blinds and it's weird and there's something strange afoot and people have lost memories and things like that.
Yeah.
So, like, it wasn't anything, like, super new in there. And even by the second episode, I was like, well, you know, I'm I like that stuff, but I'm like a little tentative. But like, yeah. there's something big happens toward the end of the second episode that for sure hooked me.
I feel like it almost has like a game changer at the end of every episode.
It does.
This episode had what I consider the biggest game changer, and just something that is just briefly glimpsed. But I was like, what the hell is that?
Is episode 3 the end of the sheriff?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, and that has a very notable thing that happens at the end. And we don't really know more about that until episode 5. Right. But there's some big stuff.
It's at least briefly glimpsed in episode 4, too. And I was like, what the hell is this?
The sheriff, played by Terrence Howard.
He was very over the top.
I loved him, though.
Oh, yeah, I did, too.
He was extremely over the top. Him showing up at their house.
His crazy ice cream fetish.
Well, you know what's interesting is that he can sort of like, he sort of vacillates as a character between kind of calmly, mildly threatening in a scene and getting like really worked up.
Yeah.
He will kind of build to this worked up anger that's not like, not usually full on like rage.
Yeah.
But it's this undercurrent of like of bristling anger,
yeah.
Even as he's like eating like an ice cream cone or something. Usually.
Well, it reminds me of Hannibal, the show Hannibal, where the worst thing you can do is be impolite.
Yeah,
right.
And that's what it is. He just wants you to follow the rules that I set down and don't question them, and everything will be okay.
So let's say what the rules are.
Yeah. So you don't talk about the past.
Yep.
Always answer the phone if it rings.
If the phone rings, always answer it.
And like at one point, the town, after like a public execution,
yeah.
they repeat this like it's a mantra.
Yeah.
And one of those mantras is literally, if a phone rings, you must pick it up.
Yeah.
And it's clear that like instructions are given.
Yep.
And people have to fall into roles.
Yep.
And not talking about the past is a big thing.
And there are cameras, listening devices everywhere.
Yep. Yeah.
And one of the creepy small bits in the first episode that I liked is when he's at the bar. So basically, he has a crash. He wakes up in this town.
Yep.
He was investigating.
He's a Secret Service agent,
right? And he's investigating the disappearance of a partner.
Two FBI, two Secret Service agents.
One of which he had an affair with.
Yes,
right. And he wakes up in this town, and the strangeness begins.
Yeah,
there's something very clearly off. The hospital he's in seems largely deserted except for him and that very strange nurse.
Well, and Melissa Leo's nurse like wants to operate on his brain.
Oh, right.
And there's very much a sense of she's going to do things you don't want her doing to your brain.
Well, so does Toby Jones. I mean,
Toby Jones, too. Yeah, but he's less menacing than she is.
Yes,
she's got a lot of menace.
Weirdly with Toby Jones is that we see him out of Wayward Pines.
Yeah.
So his ability to sort of get in and out is a little strange.
Yeah.
Right. But he ends up at a tavern, bar and grill kind of place where Juliette Lewis is bartender, and that he talks a little bit with her and seems to sort of bond. She seems to be one of the few people who's like, yeah, there is something weird going on here, but we can't quite talk here. And there's like certain safe places around town she knows, but she passes him a note with like her address on it. And on the back of the note, it says, "There are no crickets in Wayward Pines."
Yeah.
And while he's walking home or walking to the place he's staying, he hears crickets and he goes poking around in like in the bushes, basically where he hears it, to just like check. And he finds a small like little electronic box that is clearly playing the cricket sound.
Yeah.
There's lots of weird mysteries. And I was like, I don't know quite what they can do to resolve this. It's the same sort of thing that happened with Lost, although without probably about 70 or so episodes in between.
Yep.
But they have given some bigger hints as to what might be going on, even in the few episodes I've seen. I feel like I'm getting satisfying.
Well, having seen episode 5, which by the way does cover what was the end of the first book,
okay,
which has the big reveal, there is no way on earth you're going to guess it.
Okay,
there's no way on earth you're going to guess what's going on.
Well, we talked about the end of the sheriff, right? His last words are something like, "It's worse than you could ever imagine." And
yeah.
I was like, that's the kind of stuff I love in a conspiracy thing. I'm like, oh man, I want to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think some of my favorite stuff was in the fourth episode where he essentially is elected the new sheriff.
Right. And isn't he just like prowling around the office?
And they just come in and say, by the way, you're the new sheriff.
Well, they bring a cake.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and they say, and he's like, what's going on? Because he's expecting perhaps some kind of confrontation.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, we just wanted to congratulate you.
Yeah.
And suddenly, like, this menacing tone the town has had before, very menacing at times, they've like changed, and it's like he is filling the role of the guy who died.
Yeah, yeah. And they're all acting like he died mysteriously. That you know he that was an accident,
right?
Not that he was murdered by the new sheriff.
Like they've almost agreed by sort of, so there's some sort of mutual assent that this is that to just continue onward.
You know, Dave, this is also another influence. It reminds me of Night Vale a little bit. The sort of all the weird stuff, and everybody pretends there's nothing weird about it at all.
Yeah. Right. It certainly doesn't have the comedic elements of that. Although I want to say there's little bits of humor here.
There's a little dark humor in there, yeah.
And also just there's like this. Some of the characters certainly have a high level of quirk.
Yeah.
Like the sheriff and his ice cream fetish.
Yeah.
When he comes and talks to Matt Dillon's wife.
Yeah.
And he's eating ice cream in her house.
Yeah.
And she eventually gets upset with him and tells him he needs to leave right now, and he does. But before he does, he fills a bowl with ice cream, puts the rest of it in a refrigerator, and walks out with the bowl. He, like, stole ice cream.
I think there's a little bit of a hint there, because he says, you guys have a new flavor. We don't get new flavors here anymore.
Right. So it does seem like they are, I mean, we know that they are physically isolated. There's
Well,
like
and
a
also
wall.
There's a weird time travel thing.
That's right. People experience some time dilation.
Right,
I mean, like, Carla Gugino's character
been there for 12 years.
Been there for for that long.
Right, and but for Matt Dillon's character, he had an affair with her a few weeks ago.
Yeah. I don't know. The show has my attention completely, so I'm super excited for this week's episode because I know there is sort of, like you said,
It's a big one. It's a big episode, and it may be even more excited to see what they do with the rest of it. So
I want to see more creepy Hope Davis because her as a school teacher.
Yep, she's great.
Yeah, the question she's asking Dylan's son sort
Where
of
do
like.
You live?
Yeah, he's like, but she's like, what do you call home? And she like really lingers on that. And,
yeah.
Just these leading questions and this mistrust she's putting in his dad. I like that this this sort of the weird status quo that the town sort of, no matter what violent or strange thing happens, it seems like they, no matter what, must continue sort of life as normal.
Right.
And there are people who seem to, not just Juliette Lewis, but a few other people have indicated they kind of want to talk to him.
Yeah.
But they always have to kind of do it in these subtle ways because everybody is listening everywhere.
Yeah.
And there is some of that fun, what would you do kind of thing. And you know, some dangerous escapes and things like that.
I kind of want to read the books after it's all said and done. I'm curious
if it's pretty satisfying, I could easily see reading them.
So, so we recommend Wayward Pines. Mm-hmm. Not like there's a lot of other stuff on TV right now, so, you know.
Right. You might as well.
Might as well.
Don't be a punk.
That's right. And that'll about wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week. And until next time,
Yo-Jo!
And that'll wrap it up for us this week. As always, you can drop us email with topic suggestions, things you want us to hear about, or just comments on the podcast at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at roguesgallery. Check us out on Facebook. Check out our website at www.roguesgallerytx.com. Check us out on Instagram at roguesgallerytx. And if you want to help us out, go over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and a little review. We'd very much appreciate it. And we will be back next week.